Hey, welcome to Growth Minded. I'm Ed Hayes. My mission is to help people grow to become better versions of themselves through this Growth Minded podcast, exclusive interviews, and training. So one opportunity to grow is through professional development. Whether you classify work as a job, a career, or a calling, your work can provide vital psychological needs, including a sense of camaraderie, self-esteem, or purpose, depending on where you are in your life. So in today's episode, I have the privilege to speak with George Harry. We'll speak on strategies and tactics regarding professional development. I'll also ask George about his opinion on the growth mindset. So George has a 35-year track record of developing optimum solutions to complex organizational and logistic solutions. Served as a director of Johnson & Johnson's global transportation team and is currently an adjunct professor of supply chain management at Rutgers University. So I organized topics today regarding professional development in terms of your attitude, learning, and growth. So we'll kick things off with George's take on positive attitude at work and how you can help find your calling. So thank you, George, for joining today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, Eddie. My pleasure to do this.
So we'll open things up on, you know, as, you know, personally, as someone transitioning from like school full time to, you know, the first real work experience and seeing, you know, people my age, you know, going through similar transitions. What advice would you have on young people beginning their careers? On sustaining a positive attitude. I've heard in the past that life is a marathon, not a sprint. So just curious as to what strategies that you have to sustain a positive attitude throughout your career.
It's a great topic and a really, really important one. I think, you know, as I reflect back on a long career and look at myself many years ago, a lesson that I had to learn that I think is really helpful in this area is it probably a two-part one. First one is, you know, nobody likes to be around negative people. Everybody wants to be around those are positive. We spend so much time in the work environment and with our professions, making the workplace a more enjoyable environment is so important. And really that comes from people with positive energy. As I was interviewing people along the way and making hiring decisions, energy and positivity were always at the top of the list. And I could overlook some technical experience or some actual results differences when you see somebody who really has a positive attitude. So I think the first thing is really recognize how important it is. The second is, how do you keep that over such a long period of time? Careers are long. Mine was about 35 years, and some are going to be shorter than that, and some are going to be longer than that. And how do you stay positive over such a long period of time? It's really a challenge. And for me, what I tried to focus on was not getting too high or too low. All right. Throughout a career or anything you do, you're going to have a lot of great high moments, and you're going to have a lot of low ones, and not letting the low ones drag you down into negativity that can last long, I think is really, really important. So when things are going really, really dark or really difficult for you, I think it's important to pause and say, all right, let's realize that over a long period of time, we're going to have many of these valleys, we're going to get through them. And in the long run, things are really great. So it might seem a little naive to take that particular approach, but I think recognizing that there are so many highs and lows and not letting the low ones drag you down, I think is really important.
Yeah, that's a great point. Even for people, especially for people who are just starting out, a lot of the things that they may be seeing might be their first time. Like I remember my first co-op with J&J, I had a meeting and I didn't organize it as well as I could have looking back, and it I don't think it went well, but that was, so it was like a kind of one of those lows that you're mentioning, but you learn from it and you just try to improve on it next time. So when you said that, that idea, that that situation came to mind, and you know, I still kind of think what you're saying is very relevant. Don't get too high, don't get too low. See the bigger picture.
Yeah, I think if there's no other better example than what everyone's going through right now, and working in a pandemic, I mean, it is so not natural what everyone is having to deal with right now. And whether you're in your first assignment right out of school, or you've been working for 30 some years, this is generally a low point for a lot of people. The whole work environment has been disrupted. You know, the interaction with people, the spending so much time staring at a computer, it's hard to do it, but you need to step back and say, you know, it's not always going to be like this. Things are going to get back to some level of normal where it's going to be different, and not letting this current situation drag you down. And I think it's really hard for the youngest members of the workforce, those who have just graduated from college and are in their first 1 or 2 years of work, because they have such a small sample size as to what work is. And this pandemic has turned into a large part of that small sample size. So it's important to say, you know, it's not going to be like this all the time. I'm going to do the best I can to make the best of this situation. Better days are ahead.
Yeah, it's a great point. It's easy to you know, like I was saying earlier, I'm blessed to have a job right now, and it might be easy for me to lose sight of that, and then forget the bigger picture that many are going through some lows right now. And to keep that in perspective. Any other tips for almost like what you wish you knew in your 20s?
Well, you know, there's a lot of things I wish I knew in my 20s. One was, I don't know that I fully recognized how long a career was going to be. And if I did, I might have made some different investments along the way in training and personal development that may have boosted my career even further. So I took a short-term outlook. I looked at assignments, you know, one assignment at a time, as opposed to really planning out a career. I don't know that I regret it very much, because things worked out okay for me and I was very, very lucky. But I never really had a career plan. My plan was a life plan, which was, you know, to always be in proximity to my friends and family, to take care of others, to get involved outside of work. So I think if I had to do it again, I may have tried to supplement a career plan with the life plan, just so that I made sure the two were always in sync. I think the other thing is recognizing that work is not always going to be fun. And as we were mentioning before, you know, my wife has a great saying, that's why they call it work, right? I think some of us have this naive perspective that, you know, for 8 to 10 hours a day in our jobs, we're going to be smiling and laughing. And yeah, there are components of that, and some assignments more enjoyable than others. But at the end of the day, it's work. We're getting paid for it, or we're taking risks if they're small businesses, and it's work. So it's important to like your work. It can be difficult to love your work. And I think knowing the difference is pretty important.
That's a good point. Like I mentioned at the start of the podcast, that people have different classifications for work, whether it is, you know, a job or a career or a calling. So I read a book recently called Grit, and in the book they're saying that a low percentage of adults do consider their work to be a calling. And part of this book, Grit, emphasizes that it will take time for anything for you to find purpose and passion in what you're doing. It won't be an overnight thing.
Yeah, I think that's 100% accurate. It's a good learning. So I think one other thing that I was fortunate enough to recognize in my 20s was the value of mentors. And for me, I was, I grew up without a father. I lost my father at a young age. So I was always searching for a male influence. And I got it by some of the men that I worked with at work. Now, it wasn't to help me at work as much as it was to help me grow as a person. So I'm happy that I recognized that I really needed that. I latched on to a couple of mentors along the way who just taught me how to do things like take care of money, you know, become a good father, a good husband, a good coworker. So they weren't really helping me develop technically at work, but they helped me as a person. You know, many of us are really going through a pretty interesting phase in our early 20s, and we can get off to good starts or we can get off to bad starts in our careers. And one or the other can really have a long-term effect. So I was fortunate to work with some, you know, would call me in and say, "Hey, George, that wasn't such a big deal. You know, don't get too wound up about it. Recognize what you're saying to other people. I know you're passionate about this, but, you know, don't ruin a relationship over it." And, you know, others who said to me, you know, make sure you have balance in your life, you know, take care of your outside responsibilities so that you have a clear head when you're with your professional responsibilities. And I think picking the right mentors and the right people to listen to is real important. I've never been one who really migrated toward mentors being assigned, because I think people tend to say, well, this person's got this, they look the same, or they act the same, or they have similar backgrounds. I picked my own, and I was happy with the choices that I made.
That's a great point. It's something that maybe in the day-to-day that I might lose sight of as well. So I think that's a great reminder for people just starting work, is to intrinsically find someone that that motivates you and can help you grow. Like you said, not just the technical areas of your life, but in all facets.
Yeah, so and don't get caught up in the fact that they need to be someone who's a level, two levels, three levels up from them, or they need to be a lot older and wiser and all that. It can be mentorship can come in very different shapes and sizes. You know, a couple of the folks who helped me, you know, they plateaued at early levels in their careers, but I valued the balance they had in their lives and the people that they were. You know, they took care of their families. They were great husbands and fathers and community members, and didn't matter to me that they peaked at a manager level or even an analyst level. They were just great people, and I wanted to be around them and I wanted to learn from them. And, you know, later in life, when I became a leader of a community organization, my mentor was actually somebody 5 years younger than me who had gone through the same experience years before. So, you know, a mentor can be older, younger, same age. It can be, you know, same sex, different. It can come from just anyone. And I think selecting the right people who are going to be honest with you and have the same value system that you're looking for is important.
Yeah, that's great. I mentioned earlier briefly, I'm living with my uncle right now. So that's been great too, because, you know, he's teaching me about, you know, strategies that I wouldn't have known, like even financial things that may not affect my day-to-day work, but can help me grow outside of work as well. Yeah, it's been great living with him. It's been a different perspective from living with my parents. So, that's a great point. Mentorship. And even, you know, even as I did, luckily I had a few co-ops, and it was always a rewarding feeling to be able to transfer the work and transfer knowledge to, you know, the person coming up, you know, to lend a helping hand to someone who was just in your shoes a few months ago. So far, that's been some of the most rewarding things that I've seen in my young career. What have been some of the more rewarding pieces in your career?
Yeah, I think it's similar. You know, the most rewarding things, by not even close, is watching others succeed. You know, folks who you meet or come across early in your career, watching them grow over 1, 2, 5, 10, 20 years is incredibly rewarding. So watching others succeed can feel much, much rewarding than recognizing your own success. And when somebody comes to you at some point that you haven't seen in days, weeks, months, years, and says, you know, you made a difference in my life. You said this to me at this point in my life when I really needed it. It touches you. And I think you realize that there's so many small interactions and that we have with people along the way that can be so meaningful. So the thing that's most rewarding is really watching others succeed and grow. And not just because it's you and me here today, but, you know, you, a former student, you know, you're sitting in a classroom of 110 students and I'm standing in front of you trying to entertain you for 3 hours every Tuesday night. You don't realize when you're standing up there and you're looking into those 100 faces, you know, that there might be 1 or 5 or 10 or 20 or maybe all 100 who you might say something that flips a switch to them and it changes their life. And when somebody like you comes back to me after how many years since the class that we had together and invite me to do something like this, it just warms my heart that somehow you and me had a connection from professor to student that's materialized into more than that. And watching you succeed, it just makes me feel good.
Yeah, it's great. It's been, like I said earlier, before we even started recording, like just reflecting and like, I may not be able to control what happens next in life, like, but I can control if I'm reflecting on the right things, on the right memories, the right things, and the people who were catalysts early on in my career. And just remember when you're speaking on Hurricane Maria and some of the strategies that you and your team were implementing, that to me was a wake up call, where I said to myself, like, I could see myself doing supply chain because of the impact it can have on someone, delivering generators to people, water to people who need it desperately. That always resonated with me, and those memories helped me sustain a positive attitude, because while there may be things that are mundane and, you know, maybe not so exciting sometimes during the week, work week, trying to have that long-term mindset where you're thinking, I can really have a, you know, great impact on someone. Those are the things that definitely stick with me and resonate. So I'm glad that we are having this call today too. It's been, you know, great to, you know, have that class and then continue to grow afterwards.
Oh, good for you. You know, I like, one of the things that's come out of the last year is, well, there's been so many, but one of the things I really like is this phrase, essential worker. And, you know, it depending on how you look at it, it can feel like you're patronizing people, but I choose to look at it very, very differently. And I hope that the people who are in these roles, whether they are working in grocery stores or delivering packages and mail or working in healthcare environments, I hope that they view themselves with that phrase in mind, that it's just not a label that other people put on them. So if you look at yourself as an essential person, an essential worker, as opposed to just doing a job, it can make the whole work experience much more rewarding. You know, we used to, when you looked at what we did in supply chain management, you know, you could look at it like, hey, yeah, I get stuff delivered, big deal. You know, what's the big deal? It's shampoo or it's cosmetics or it's whatever. But, you know, we used to stop and every once in a while, particularly with the pharmaceuticals and medical devices that we would deliver, and say, you know, we may have saved somebody's life today. We rushed something, we got something delivered to a hospital, and it was there in time for a surgery, and somebody's life might have been saved or enhanced as a result of our efforts. So we could choose to look at it like, yeah, I got something delivered, or yeah, I got something delivered that really made a difference. And how you look at that same situation can really determine how fulfilled you feel about the work that you do or not. And it's all in the attitude that you take in looking at it.
Yeah, great point, George, on that. Further on that book, I was speaking on grit, like this psychologist is saying that to have like a growth mindset is to basically believe that your capabilities aren't limited and you can expand them. And part of it comes into your attitude on how you face a problem. So pessimists and optimists may see the same amount of some of those valleys that you're saying, those peaks, the highs and the lows. And this psychologist is saying that folks with the growth mindset are typically more optimistic, but also more gritty in how they approach life, because I think it may be easier to like you're saying, to say, oh, you know, I've only, I'm just delivering stuff here, compared to, you know, having that optimistic state of mind where you're saying this can actually save someone's life. So that's a great point on that.
Yeah. And just to expand on that a little bit, Ed is, you know, there's so much that happens in life that you can't control. You can't control weather. You can't control what happens to other people. You can't really, an individual can't control what happens politically. There's so much out of your control. A lot of health issues are out of your control. The two things that I think you can always control are your effort and your attitude. And this is what I try to drill into my own kids, or, you know, when I was coaching others or leading others, it's your effort that matters and your attitude that matters. And I believe that those are fully in each of our control. And sometimes we tend to focus on things that are so out of our control that we lose sight of what's in our control, which is those two key things. Another, and it's a little bit in sync with effort, is, you know, what do you plan for? You know, do you can control what you spend your time planning for, or the strategies that you set. But for the most part, effort and attitude. And I think when you feel like things are out of control, or particularly out of your control, if you focus on your effort and your attitude, I think things can be more positive, and you're going to get much, much better outcomes and feel better about it than just feeling like I have no control, I'm a victim, and things are always going to happen poorly to me. So effort and attitude matter.
Agreed. So switching roles from, you know, attitude into learning a little bit, you mentioned, and currently you're adjunct professor in supply chain management at Rutgers. So what are some of the strategies that you use? Maybe you don't even think of them as strategies. It's just a habit, but ways that you made the classroom office setting more interesting,
yeah,
or engaging.
Yeah. And you know, I learned a lot from the time I started through the each semester that I taught. So I tried to continually improve upon, you know, what I was doing. And I did the best I could. I wasn't really an academic, so I wasn't trained to be a teacher or a professor. But, you know, what I tried to do along the way is a couple things. The first one is make the subject practical and understandable. All right. A lot of what's taught in academia can be highly technical and can be, I'd say you could be taught stuff that you may never, ever use. So I think recognizing, connecting the topic to people's lives through current events, real world scenarios, practical problems and solutions, I think was the best. So instead of academically talking about how you technically respond to a major surge in volume, I'd rather put that in the context of how do you plan for something like Black Friday, where there's a significant surge in volume, and talking about what causes a Black Friday spike in shopping, how do you plan for it, as opposed to looking at a situation like that academically. I think many professors are really, really good at this, and particularly the newer ones, and particularly those who come from the working world, as opposed to just through academia. So connecting the material to what goes on in real life. That's what I tried to do in the classroom. Another is, don't ask a question on a test that an individual, that I used my benchmark. So in 30 years of work, if I never needed to know something like that, I didn't ask a student about it. So I tried to only ask questions that may have a material impact over their long careers. And another is the format of which you grade or make assignments. And like writing academic papers is something that in 35 years of work, I never had to do. So why teaching my class should I have a student write a 15-page paper with all the citations and sightings and research and all that? Those who are going to go into a career in supply chain management are 99% of them are never going to have to do that. So why make an assignment? In a career, you are going to have to know a topic, make a presentation, try to convince somebody of your point of view. So I would rather assign team presentations than individual academic research papers. They're just much more practical. And I was a guest speaker in a former colleague's class a few months ago. And one of the assignments that she gives to her students is each week they have to write her an email on a particular topic, which I thought was brilliant. She's teaching them not only how to write something that's meaningful, but to put it in a format that these folks are going to use every day in their careers, which is write a convincing email. And I really applaud her for taking that approach with her students. So back to your original question, I think what I try to do in a classroom is make it real, make it practical, and something that could really happen in people's lives, as opposed to overly emphasizing theory and theoretical solutions.
Yeah, that's great. I remember the team presentations. That's it's very useful because if you're an intern or you're finishing up a presentation, at the end of your assignment, you do have to make a presentation. So I think that public speaking is very practical. Like I remember preparing for the team assignment at Rutgers, I was basically just, I had all my roommates sitting on the bed and I was making the same speech to them. And years later, it still comes into play. So I remember that part. And then I remember, I think there is a piece on, I think it was lean or efficiencies, where you have 100 people spread out throughout the class. And then we're like, how long would it take to get this document signed? I don't remember higher level of that piece, but the practical piece was that even in lean and stuff, it's important to, you know, have step A, step B, step C closer to each other than, you know, having step A maybe in one country, step B in another country, and whether it's manufacturing or
I mean, it was a practical, it was an exercise, a hands-on exercise, which I students always enjoyed doing that. And I wish I did more of those in class. As class sizes got bigger and bigger, it got more difficult to do those. Like the first time I taught, I had 40 students. For the last couple classes I had, it was well over 100. So as class sizes get bigger, it gets harder to do those. But you know, class exercises are important. You know, nobody wants to listen to some professor talk for 3 hours straight, and no professor can talk for 3 hours straight and really connect with a student. It's very difficult to do. So I think adding some variety and making things practical are things that help the most.
Great. I remember, I think it was during a co-op, you were a guest speaker, and you brought up the idea of a stretch assignment. And that's something that that's a practical thing that I've used in my career so far. Can you explain what a stretch assignment is to our listeners on the Growth Minded podcast? I think that's something that not many people would know to do.
Yeah, thank you. It starts from a belief that I have that, you know, we all have a full plate. I mean, very few people really don't have a full day's worth of work. You know, after years of industry consolidation and reorganizations, you know, people have got more and more responsibility on their shoulders. But I believe that you can always find personal capacity and space in your day if there's something that you really want to do to improve yourself or to develop further, like to make space for personal development. So a stretch assignment would be, you know, when you carve out a certain amount of your day or days of week or something like that, a percentage of your time, essentially, to do something completely different, ideally in another function, that in another working for different people, that's testing different skill set of yours. So, you know, if you work in supply chain, if you work in a distribution area all day long, you know, make 20% of your time available to go work for the customer service department. Learn what they do. Take a chunk of their work and do it for yourself. So, you know, you get the opportunity to learn a different function. You're working for a different team for that 20% of the time. So you're expanding your network and building a reputation with other people that can really help you in your career. So a stretch assignment should be something that uses a different skill set that you have, or you apply that skill set to a different area. Some people are really talented analytically, and being able to take their analytical skills from one department to another without leaving their job, I think can really benefit them. They get to learn a different department, and that second department gets the benefit of the skill set from the individual. So a stretch assignment should be one that you can do within your current role just by creating space in your day, becoming, you know, more efficient, making more time available, and pushing yourself to apply the skills that you already have to another area, or to develop skills in a different department. And I think it's important for personal growth to do that. Staying in the same department, doing the same things over and over and over again, you know, you kind of hit a growth plateau. So stretch assignments, I think, expand your ability to grow.
Yeah, great point. Even recently, like how I organize priorities is like I use OneNote, and then I'll have similar to how like a syllabus will look like week over week. But you know, imagine like a 4x4 or 5x5 top five priorities, and I started one of the headers I started to do is just stretch, and it might just like a stretch assignment. And they may like, it may be blank, but then it in my head, it's like, let's, you know, stretch in some small way today, whether it's, you know, reaching out to a new contact, you know, trying to set up a quick call with someone, small ways that I can try to stretch if it's not, if I don't have that, you know, 20% of time that I can offer in another department. But still, I think the stretch assignment helps tie into building career resilience, networking, developing existing skills or even new skills, And I think that's critical because I've read in today's world, things are, you know, pretty competitive, and that reskilling is something that will continue to be necessary for people just entering the workforce. Like, they may know one skill for 5 years, but, you know, maybe after 5 years, that skill is less in demand than another skill.
I can tell you without question that that is 100% accurate. And, you know, I look back at one point in my career, I go back a long time, right? So my first role, the personal computer came out in the mid 80s to the office, and no one had ever seen them or used them before. And I was 22 or 23 years old. And I said, you know, I'm going to master this thing, and I'm going to be the wizard in the office. And I did. I became the greatest Lotus 1-2-3 expert that my company had ever seen, particularly in our office. And people came to me, and I did all those there. I built these kind of spreadsheets for them, and I showed them what Lotus can do. And I was the expert. Well, lo and behold, 3 years later, Lotus 1-2-3 died, and Excel came along, and I was slow to learn Excel. I was still holding on to Lotus, and it took years for me to catch up because I didn't try to learn Excel while I was working in Lotus, and others passed me by and became the experts in Excel, which was current, while I was holding on to Lotus. So it goes with what you just said. I mean, the skill needs are changing, and you need to recognize what's changing and change with it. If you try to hold on to things that are dying, it's not a good strategy or formula.
The only comparison I can think of offhand is, like, maybe even, I think Excel will continue to be around, but I know, like, with data visualizations, Excel, they've used, you know, charts and pivots in the past. And then I've had a small experience with, like, Power BI, where that pulls in, you know, maybe data sets from different areas, different departments. And then the data visuals on that is very intuitive. And so that might be something I'm interested in down the
line.
That's
right. Now, Power BI, the people who have those skills are the hot commodities right now, as opposed to those in Excel. And it's someday the people that are holding on to Power BI, they're going to become extinct. So it's just important to recognize the wave and catch the wave, as opposed to just waiting for it to go away, because most of the times it doesn't. Excel has kind of become a cost of entry. You need to know Excel to get in the door. Power BI is what kind of pushes you along the continuum. That's going to change. Someday Power BI will be the cost of entrance, and something else will be what the differentiator is.
That's great. And that ties into the stretch assignment. So thanks for going into detail on that piece. So the last topic that we can discuss with a few questions regards growth. We spoke on attitude. We spoke on different ways to learn, whether it's the way you present what you're trying to convey to others in an interesting way, or ways that you can stretch. So in terms of growth, the podcast is called Growth Minded, and the philosophy behind that is that people can grow. If it's basically a belief that you have a capacity to improve your situation from where you currently stand. And it kind of contrasts a lot from what we see even in our culture, like things like the X Factor or America's Got Talent, where people, they're conveying that, you know, these people just have the it factor, or just they just have it. So I was just curious if you were familiar with the growth mindset, and if you believe that people are born with an X factor, or more of a natural grow, fail, and develop over time.
Yeah, you know, I'm not familiar with all the details and all the descriptions and components of what fits into the growth mindset package. But if assuming it, we're talking about leadership, are you born with it or do you develop it over time? I think there's some of both. It might be a cop-out answer, but I do think there's some of both. And I think of people I've known my whole life, some folks who were leaders when we were young kids are still leaders today, and others who were very shy and kind of background people early in life are leaders today. And some vice versa. Some folks that were hotshots when we were younger or early in our career have kind of faded and you know, not really developed. So, you know, I think that there are some people who are born with this natural tendency to have people connect to them and migrate to them. It's often a personality trait. They're engaging. They look people in the eye. They compliment others. They're fun to be around. They're positive. And there you have some, you know, a level of intelligence. So people really like being around those. And those individuals who keep those characteristics carry the benefits of that throughout their entire lives. They're just fun people to be around. And they're always assuming leadership positions. People want to work for them. People want to be around them so they continue to flourish. You know, there are other people who along the way, you know, something flips their switch and they get motivated. They see something. Something happens in their lives. Some individual motivates them. And they say, hey, I want to be better than I am. And I want to be a leader too. And so they read or they practice or they take stretch assignments. They go to classes to learn how to be better at public speaking. Or they train in a particular area and they become leaders. So I really think it can be both. I think there are some people who have this natural way about them and they will their entire lives. I'm envious of those folks because it seems to come easy to them. And then there are others who, again, something happens to them. It can be positive. It can be negative and really motivate them. And they say, I want a better life and I want to be a leader and I want to help others. And they do a lot of things to grow and do that. So I think anybody who can along the way be influenced and motivated by those things that happen to them can turn the corner and be something special. And sometimes it just takes somebody saying the right thing to them to make it happen.
Great. And it ties into your point on the things, the controllables, control the controllables, attitude and effort. So I think that would be my humble opinion on that piece too, just to add to what you're saying.
Yeah, I'll give you a real small example, and it might sound stupid, but I'm going to give it to you anyway, all right? So I was working with an individual in the team I was on whose responsibilities were going to be to work to represent our company with a bunch of outside vendors. And she was at a level lower in the organization and I was at a level, you know, a couple levels up. And she was going to be interacting with people at senior levels outside of the company. And she said, well, they're not going to want to talk to me. I'm just a analyst. And I'm like, you're not an analyst. You are the CEO of that conversation. Are you sure? I don't need a title. I'm like, no, it's your responsibility. You own it. They have to recognize that. Go get them. And that individual kind of took that literally. To their credit, they didn't just say, oh, George is, you know, full of himself. They took my advice. They took control of their situation, changed their attitude, and said, you know what, I'm responsible for this. They're going to have to deal with me. I'm in charge of this conversation. And she's had an amazing career that, you know, may or may not have been influenced by somebody giving them that sense of authority or power or whatever you want to call it. And, you know, I'm really proud of what she's accomplished in her career. And, you know, it may have come from that simple conversation that says, hey, it's yours. Go get it.
That's great. The CEO, I'll take a note on that after I listen to this again. The CEO of your conversation.
Yeah, I mean, we're all looking for, you know, some people are just always looking for an excuse. You know, some people are comfortable playing the victim. You know, I don't have the right title. I don't have the right authority. And other people just take it. You know, they take it and run with it. And that attitude difference is really what can separate people.
So a few more questions for you, George, before we wrap it up. What's a second skill beyond supply chain that you developed in parallel with your career, throughout your career? For example, you know, even a small habit or hobby like reading is something that I like to do on the side. And it's practical because if you read something that's helpful, you can implement it in work. I'll give you a quick example. Like, I was reading this book on the power of habit, and they have the CEO from Alcoa, I guess, from what I remember, it's like an aluminum company. And there's a lot of injuries going on in these factories. And what was practical and helpful from the second skill of reading is that the CEO of Alcoa at the time basically laid out a way to solve a problem. So he said, where's the process going wrong? Who can help us fix this process? And basically, what's the resolution? So that's something that I was able to grab from the second skilling of reading this particular book and then implement it in some of the things that I see at work to help solve problems. So curious on your take on this piece.
Yeah, I mean, a second skill for me that I was always trying to develop was teaching and communicating and mentoring. As opposed to just focusing on the work I was doing and, you know, learning the business and learning the technical parts of what I did. You know, the skill I tried to develop, particularly as I was progressing in the organization and having wider responsibilities, was, you know, how can I teach others and how can I mentor others? And a lot of that comes from, you know, how you communicate, whether it's one-on-one communicating in front of groups, whether it's email, whether it's presentations. So the skill that I was lacking the most early in my career that I worked the hardest at was communication. I grew up very shy. I'm an introvert by definition. Every time I do one of those personal analysis, I come up a real deep introvert. So it was hard for me to get the energy to be extroverted and communicate, particularly in front of large audiences. So what I did in one of my early assignments was I started volunteering to do campus recruiting for my company, just so I could stand in front of a group of students and work on my presentation skills and my communication skills. And I had to, you know, stand at like career fairs and talk to people all day long, which were things I was not comfortable with, presentations and small talk. So developing that second skill was something that was really important to me. And I think it really helped me. So it still is harder for me as an introvert than it is for people who are more extroverted, but it was something that I picked out to work on as a second skill.
That's a good story. You know, picking something that you saw as a weakness and then turning it into a strength later in life.
I went through 4 years of college. I think I raised my hand 3 or 4 times in 4 years. And I'm ashamed of that because I was afraid. I went to a school where I thought everybody in the room was smarter than me. I thought that if you raised your hand and spoke, you were sucking up to the teacher. And both of those things were really stupid attitudes for me to take. I wasted 4 years of potential learning and interaction and networking with fellow students and professors. And I wanted to fix that. And I wanted to get past my insecurities of communication skills. So I really set out to address that early in my career. And I'm glad I did it. It opened up a lot of things for me.
And I hope if anyone's listening from some of these bigger schools, especially Rutgers, you go earlier, even earlier in your, some of the classes that you take, 100 people, you know, 50 people, can be intimidating to ask a question. Now it's, you know, another layer of complexity where you're not one-on-one with the teacher. So that barrier of not even being in the same classroom may add another layer of complexity, but still, I think it's important to reach out to your teachers, to your professors, not to suck up, like you're saying, or not because you're afraid, but to try to get the best out of yourself. And the people who are teaching the subject, when they have a lot of enthusiasm, they can teach you something you don't know, basically, is what I'm trying to say. And so I hope, you know, people from some of these bigger schools that may be listening take that into consideration throughout their time in college.
I think that's good advice. I tell my sons this, two of them, one of them's graduated, two of them are in college now. Get to know your professors. They can help you, that you can learn from them. They're not just people standing in front of you spewing at you. They're people who have experiences and networks that can really help you and influence you. So if you sit there like I did for 4 years and not get involved really in the classroom, you're missing out on part of the experience. So I encourage those to others to really get involved in what's going on in the classroom.
Great. And last question for you. What do you think that, you know, people from our generation can learn from those before us and vice versa?
Yeah, I think there's a couple key things. The first one for me, it might not come out right, is patience. All right. Today's generation wants everything right away. And it's because of so many advancements in technology, and just the world is so different now than when I started my career. But a career is a marathon. All right. And if you're going to define your career by a single thing or today's interaction or what happens tomorrow, it's what you do over the long run, I think, that really matters. So having some level of patience, and I'm not saying, well, you need to wait 5 years before you get promoted, but I am saying, you know, you probably don't deserve to get promoted in 3 months. And there are some people who would come up to me after 3 months on a job and say, you know, I'm ready for the next level. I'm like, no, you're not. There's so much more to learn before you're really ready, you know, to move forward and make a difference. So the patience is one of the things that I think today's generation needs to have a little bit more appreciation for. And I hope I don't come across as a dinosaur for saying that. And the next one is the value of relationships. And I worry a little bit that the generation starting their career right now are so into electronic communication, they're going to struggle with person-to-person communication. And I know there's more ways to communicate electronically now, but there's still a value on eye contact and face-to-face communication and personal interaction. And I hope that it's not expected that won't be important moving forward. So I hope this generation doesn't completely lose one-on-one personal interaction.
Great. And I think it does tie a lot into the technology that we were kind of born into in a way. And yeah, for me, patience trying to have a long-term mindset towards goals or things like that. I think that's important. And then even, you know, having conversations with people my age, whether they're friends or peers, like just trying to be fully present to that other person and not thinking about, you know, where's my phone or what's the next notification, things like that. I think that's something that, you know, luckily is a value that and that my family instilled on me growing up. And I think it's something that will be valuable in the long run as well.
Yeah, that's good, because I think some of this multitasking is really a negative. Right? I know we all need some level of multitasking just to get through the day, because there's so much that comes at us during the course of the day. But I think you said it well, knowing when to be fully present is real important. And, you know, there are people who you can tell they're not paying attention to you, and it's belittling, it's disrespectful, and it kind of makes you say, you know, why would I do anything for that person? They don't think I'm important enough to focus on me for one minute. So I think keeping the multitasking to a realistic and knowing amount and knowing when it's completely inappropriate, I think is important too.
Great. So we'll close things out. This is Growth Minded. My mission is to help people become better versions of themselves through this podcast, interviews, and training. Today we spoke on professional development, whether you classify work as a job, career, or calling. Hopefully this conversation can help you see that camaraderie, self-esteem, and purpose are possible throughout your career. And I want to thank George again for joining this conversation. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ed. Good luck to you.
Thank you. All right, and to close things out, I'll have the Growth Minded link available, and you can follow Growth Minded on Instagram, subscribe to our YouTube channel, and join our LinkedIn group for more great content. So thanks for listening. I'll talk to you guys soon.